This is 69, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry since the dawn of man, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon, and into what stuff actually means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. The podcasts are free and I try to get a new one out weekly, but I travel a lot so sometimes I'll miss a week. The 69 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported since the start by Jeremy Gavin and the fine folks at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at screenfeed.com. In a technology landscape where even last year's big thing tends to get old quickly, it's pretty amazing that the lobby-filled LED installation at the Comcast Tower in Philadelphia remains one of the best visual experience projects out there, more than 12 years after it was first lit up. If the project is unfamiliar, imagine walking into a very large corporate office tower lobby, admiring the wood walls that line it, and then seeing those walls are active and that there are little visual stories being told. The project went live when few people, even in this industry, knew all that much about DirectView LED, doing a 4mm wall years ahead of when AV people started thinking and marketing in terms of pixel pitch. I spoke with David Niles, whose little company did the original job and continues to work on it through a recent LED upgrade. We get into his long background, starting in architecture and early computer graphics, and evolving into pioneering work with HDTV, again years ahead of when people were using terms like 1080p. We also talk about some of the other work done by his team. I spoke with Niles last week as he puffed a morning cigar in his Central Florida backyard. I was staring out of my Nova Scotia backyard, wondering when predicted snow flurries were going to blow in. Oh well, he won. David, we'll get into the Comcast experience, but that's not the only work you've done through the years. Can you tell me about your company and what you do?
Well, if I would start backwards.
Sure.
I mean, what we do today is I make large-scale multimedia experiences, mostly for, I guess you would call it public art, spaces and buildings, sometimes residences all over the world. And that's sort of, that's what I do today. Where I started is, it's a long list, but I'll try and go through it quickly. I really started out in architecture. As a kid, I was fascinated with building and really enamored with architecture. I thought it was extremely noble. I was 10, 12 years old. I was reading all of Frank Lloyd Wright's books and studying his plans. By the time I was 12 or 13, I taught myself how to be a draftsman. And I could draft. And eventually went out in my early career designing and building outdoor cafes, stores, interiors in New York City. But was always frustrated with this idea that as noble as I thought architecture was, it was turning into this sort of commodity of more, run-of-the-mill things. And that I believed that the future of dynamic art was really in that thing called television. So very early on, I was fascinated with the idea of television and the medium of video, and was in the early part of my career involved with video art in the very early pioneers of video art in New York City, where we would run out with a porta pack and shoot all kinds of things that we thought were art. Parallel to that was involved with music and music recording and engineering, sort of all together, and theater to some extent, live theater. And that eventually melded into me getting more and more involved with the medium of video and television, summarily rejecting the idea of broadcast television. It was terrible, the Ed Sullivan Show, it's terrible graphics, horrible lighting, and all this other stuff. And until one day I was, sitting in a loft, with some friends of mine, and we're looking at this video art that we were making. And other than the three or four people in this room looking at some, protracted, very boring thing that we shot with our quarterbacks, and realized that we really weren't doing anything. And that maybe, being popular and television needed change, needed revolution. So I decided at that moment that it was more important to get involved with the idea of changing television and bringing art to the popular medium rather than, you know, narrow casting in this, you know, what, three or four guys in a room looking at, you know, video feedback on a monitor and thinking it's wonderful. So I started to get more involved with the idea of taking what was then non-broadcast equipment and seeing if I could adapt this into making, you know, more popular video with it. And I was about, well, I guess 18 or 19 years old. I met up with an investor that lived in France, who thought my ideas for creating a revolutionary mobile unit that would permit us to go out and shoot, you know, and create on the spot more organically, you know, without all of the without all of the baggage of what broadcast television was, at least in those days. If you wanted to go out and shoot outside, you were talking about a 50-foot trailer with, you know, 25 guys with screwdrivers and, you know, cameras that weighed 400 mm-hmm. pounds. And he put up the money to invest in making a video mobile unit, that would permit us to do that. And it was a long story, but eventually that mobile unit ended up in France. And he invited me over to shoot a jousting competition in Carcassonne. And this mobile unit that I built, this is a one man show. This is one guy that had 1 2-inch machine, three IVC 300 cameras. These were like semi-professional. Well, they were professional cameras, but they were not, you know, high-end RCA or Marconi cameras. In this sort of, it almost looked like a bread truck. It was a small van that housed all of this stuff. And I basically went to France to shoot this jousting competition, and ended up staying in France, and convincing this investor to let me take it apart and rebuild it and make it better. And this is years before there was any sort of private television or private videotape production in France. It was only state-owned television. And we pioneered the idea of creating broadcast facilities in France to supply the French channels and eventually American and basically world channels for sporting events. Years later, I was able to buy out the original investor, because business was very, very slow for the first five or six years, and set up my first company in France, where we ended up building that first original mobile unit, but ended up building 9 more and became the premier facility in Europe for HBO, ABC, CBS, French television, German television, English television. In high-end video production. That was France. Of course, pioneering, I was always pushing the envelope of never being satisfied with the state of the art of the existing equipment. It was too heavy. It was too complicated. It wasn't innovative enough. So I have sort of an engineering side where I would go back and look at this hardware that existed at the time and modify it, adapt it, and create these, well, sort of revolutionary for their time, outside broadcast vehicles and studios. And somewhere in the early 80s, I had a reputation for being a sort of a hardware pioneer, and Sony and RCA were constantly throwing new ideas at me and new products that they were developing. Sony came along and they said, "We have something we want to show you, David." I said, "What would that be?" "Something called high definition television." And they took me into a room, and they showed me, the very first prototypes for high def TV, and a transfer of this high def TV that was made to 35 millimeter film. And I looked at it, and it blew me away. It was holy mackerel. Now, this was a frustration that we'd had in Europe for something that Americans wouldn't understand, is that if you produced 65 PAL television on videotape, the French channels would not accept it. They would not accept videotape. They would only accept 35 millimeter film. So everything that we produce, whether it be a TV commercial or anything else, or even a commercial for the cinemas, because in France they put commercials in cinema, we would have to convert our videotape to film. And the only way to do it in the 70s was to do an elaborate kinescope process that Technicolor had developed. So we would have to produce absolutely perfect 625 television, 625 PAL television, and then take it through this kinescope process to create, well, 35 millimeter film that looked pretty good. But of course, it's, you know, it's limited in resolution and contrast ratio, but it looked pretty good. So we were constantly trying to get the best we could possibly get. So when I saw HDTV for the first time, you know, looking at a video picture with a better than 1,000 line resolution and a contrast ratio that was amazing, I was blown away. And I said, I've got to do that. So I spent several years negotiating with the NHK in Japan and Sony to give me the, to allow me to buy the equipment to launch HDTV, which is what we did eventually. In France, we opened up the first studios in the world that actually produced HDTV, not necessarily for broadcast, but for transferring to 35 millimeter film, because we looked at it as either A, a new medium, or a medium that would compete with 35 millimeter film, which is, the beginning of the HDTV revolution. Eventually, our studios in France were very successful, and we had, we produced the first commercials in HDTV, the first movies in HDTV, the plethora of stuff. And a lot of our customers were calling from America, New York. And I said, wow, I need to expand my company to open up a New York office, which is what we did in 1987. We opened up 1125 Productions in New York, which was a fully equipped HDTV studio and production facilities in New York City. I mean, it was an enormous financial investment. But parallel, if you know the history of HDTV, HDTV in 1987 was a very, 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 disputed medium. American broadcasters really didn't want to know about it. The cinema community, of course, no way, you're not going to replace, anything. You're not going to replace this beautiful film medium with anything electronic. So it was a very challenging uphill battle. It's a very long, procured story, protracted story. So I'll try and make it shorter. 1125 Productions was mostly a very sophisticated post-production studio that we had on Fifth Avenue with mobile units. Eventually, I needed to start to produce HDTV programming of my own to start to fill the void. So we needed a studio, and we eventually took over the Ed Sullivan Theater, where we built HDTV studios in New York City. And that's sort of my television career. There's a lot involved. I'd say it's a long story after that. My roots in storytelling and show business, theater, music, et cetera, everything else sort of lend itself to, again, going back to this idea of these enormous pictures and this enormous, experiential things that we could do with HDTV that we really couldn't do with any other video medium. So in the Sullivan Theater, we built a 60-foot screen and did absolutely photorealistic projection. And we opened up a Broadway show called Dreamtime that ran for 145 performances. And the big feature of Dreamtime, aside from being successful, was that it fully integrated photorealistic HDTV imagery that was projected with live actors. And you couldn't tell the difference between the live actors and the projection. Which was actually a really cool show.
What year was that?
That's 1992.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. and people still, if you Google Dreamtime, you'll see that there's even a Wikipedia page that some people put on. I had nothing to do with it. There's a Wikipedia page up that talk about it. And it's we eventually then sold the Ed Sullivan Theater to CBS to do the Letterman show. I opened up studios around the corner in the Studio 54 building and continued doing HDTV and other stuff, and then got involved with Radio City Music Hall and Madison Square Garden, again in the idea of HDTV, but more so with the with Radio City Music Hall and their desire to expand the holiday show, which is their most important production that they do in there, into bringing an LED screen at that time, one of the largest in the world, that covered the whole back of the stage to be able to embellish the Radio City Music Hall Christmas show, which we did. We put the screen up and we created an entire animated and coordinate synced background for the, you know, for their holiday show, with great success. And that brings us to where Comcast came into all of this.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of connective tissue here that I wasn't really aware of.
Yeah, it was interesting. Mm-hmm. Comcast, well, the backstory for Comcast is Comcast, in the year 2000, was basically a lot of administrative offices spread, you know, pretty much in separate office buildings all over Philadelphia. And Comcast became the major tenant for a spec building that was being proposed by a company called Liberty Property Trust. Liberty Property Trust are real estate developers in the Philadelphia area. And my original contact was with the real estate developer that came to me in, I guess it was 2000. 1999, and they had this idea to do this spec 53-story office building in Philadelphia, and they wanted to create a sales center to pitch either anchor tenants or many tenants for their revolutionary new 1,000-foot-tall building. And they found me, and they came in, they saw what we could do, and I came up with an idea for creating a sales floor with a lot of virtual things and a lot of features that was like this experience that as soon as you walked off the elevator, it was one long, interesting, almost theme park ride to sell you on the idea of moving into this building. Mm-hmm. The main feature of this thing was a room you ended up in that I designed that was in the shape of an oval. And you would sit in this room and it looked like, you know, you were in this oval shaped room. And in front of you was a 16-foot wide by 10-foot tall granite wall. And this granite wall was actually one of the materials of the spec building that Stern had designed that Liberty Property Trust wanted to build. And the lights would dim automatically and it would go into this 10-minute show that we produced, that would start out making you believe that this is going to be a sales pitch for, you know, a building. It's going to have 25 elevators and it's made of granite and it's got 4,000 office spaces, you know. And it all of a sudden you're now going through this 10-minute thing about falling in love with Philadelphia, with shots of Philadelphia and interviews with Dell and other key people and the architect, about the wonderfulness of being in Philadelphia and why you needed to be in this building. It was very compelling, absolutely beautiful film. And at the end of the film, it goes back to this granite wall, and this granite wall slides away physically, and it reveals a real windows that are actually looking out onto the site for which this building is going to be built. Mm. And like a long story short, the lead tenant for this building became Comcast. Comcast decided at that moment that they wanted to unify all of their 5,000 workers into this new building, and that this was going to be their new headquarters. Eventually, as they started to build the building, Brian Roberts, who's the CEO of Comcast, had made frequent trips to Japan. He's a very innovative guy, absolutely really smart, lots of instinct. He decided that this lobby that Stern had designed, this huge lobby, all of these wood panels, he wanted something that was going to make his 5,000 employees inspired and feel good about moving into this new building. The developer that developed the building wanted to, at the same time, create an instant destination for this new tallest building in Philadelphia. And they basically, I had just finished doing Radio City, and they'd heard about it, and they invited me to pitch them my ideas for what to do in there. And our pitch was, we wanted to do something that was unexpected. And we created a whole bunch of animatics and things. We said, well, you know, if you put screens up in the lobby, you're going to do time and temperature. And because Comcast is basically a cable TV operation, you know, we're going to put up 1,000 channels. I mean, things that would be typical that looked fine. And then I said, well, wait a minute. Let's talk about the unexpected. What don't we expect to see? How can we incorporate something that is ever-changing and inspiring without interfering with what I consider to be private time of the public? Private time of the public means that, I mean, you come through the front door of Comcast, you're walking towards the elevator. You can't do things that are too intrusive, that are screaming at you, not audio wise, but screaming at you for your attention. Mm-hmm. For the Comcast side, it was doing something that would be more a gift to the city, something that was more socially redeeming without being video art, you know, video art in a negative sense, mm-hmm. that had some meaning. For the Liberty Property Trust side, it was, there's a SEPTA station, a subway station that's underneath the Comcast building, and there's another 10,000 people that come through that lobby every day. How can we create a meaningful destination for these people coming up the staircase that allows them to enjoy something and then not feel as though they're missing something if they walk away from it? So we created this idea of, one, doing the unexpected, and two, using theatrical things, because people relate to people, where we take ordinary people doing extraordinary things that are like fun things to watch. And from that, we created, you know, this whole plethora of things that could happen up there. And then Comcast came back and they said, you know, David, these ideas are great. This is wonderful. We love it. But how do you create hundreds of hours, thousands of hours of original programming? Because we don't want to be, you know, constantly producing for this thing, because it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. And keep it fresh. So I went back and designed what we call a content delivery system, which is it's the system for which, you know, how we actually get this content up onto the screen, that is ever changing, that's able to create its own content by connecting pieces of pre-recorded content together in a logical fashion, not random. Mm-hmm. So that it stayed fresh. And Brian Roberts said, okay, David, you can do this, but you've got to guarantee me that I will have 2 years worth of content that's going to be, that's going to remain valid and appear to be new all the time, without creating hundreds of thousands of hours. Remember that basically scenarios in the Comcast Center, they last about a minute. You know, there's a minute, and then it'll go back to being, you know, this wood wall where it disappears and it'll come back. We rotate about 1,200 pieces of content every day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just that's a quantity of content that's impossible. I mean, yeah, broadcast stations don't even do this.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit ScreenFeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
And this was the mid to late 2000s, and nobody was talking about DirectView LED then, no. Other than, you know, people were referring to them as jumbotrons.
Well, that was the first challenge. The first challenge was, okay, In the mid-2000s, you were looking at, you know, LED screens that were 6mm, 8mm, 10mm, Jumbotron. Mm-hmm. So it was first because I needed this to be photorealistic. You had to believe that what you were looking at was actually real. That was part of the magic of it. So I had a longstanding relationship with Barco Broadcast from my mm-hmm. television days, because they make a lot of broadcast products. And Barco was you know, doing LED, but LED in 6mm, 8mm. And I went back to Barco, and with Barco engineers, we developed the idea of doing a 4mm pixel pitch wall, which for 2006 is revolutionary. We did tests. We set up 8 screens in studios in New York. We did subjective tests, against, you know, there were other competing companies that wanted to build this screen. Mitsubishi mm-hmm. wanted to build this screen. Daktronics wanted to build this screen. And we eventually ended up developing this with Barco. Comcast eventually, you know, was convinced that Barco was the way to go. And we ended up doing the first NX4, huge screen. I mean, it's 80 feet wide. It's about almost 6,000 pixels wide. This was revolutionary, for its time. And then, of course, content delivery system to be able to deliver to this. I mean, there were no servers that would do anything and no pipeline that would do anything larger than HDTV, 1920 by 1080. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to feed something that's 2,000 pixels wide by 10,000 pixels across. I mean, that's not going to happen. So we ended up designing and building a content delivery system that was capable of doing that. But again, Brian Roberts and Comcast came back to me and they said, "Listen, this is the front face of our building. This is our image. This has to be mission critical." And of course, I go back to my, you know, my days in television where there's no such thing as something going wrong. You know, you don't do a live mm-hmm. downhill skiing event from Switzerland that's feeding 20 million television sets. There's no such thing as, oops, the camera doesn't work. That doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does, but you don't see it. So in designing the content delivery system, we designed several levels of redundancy such that in the event of any failure behind the scenes, that it would automatically switch over and change so that, you know, the problem would remain invisible out on the screen. And in the first 8 years of operation, the screen was never turned off. It never, ever went down. Hmm. Now, after 8 years of operation, a couple of years ago, we actually, you know, it was the end of life for the NX4, so we actually changed all of that. But basically, the new installation, the new content delivery system, and the new screen is based on the same original designs of what levels of redundancy we had built in, that you can't see the problem if it does, you know, if there is a problem. And eventually, I mean, it's a lot of hardware. Things do go wrong, but you just can't see them.
So how does Comcast, how do they know this is working? How do they measure that this is having the desired impact?
You know, that's a really great question, because Brian Roberts is constantly analyzing. He's very analytic. And even when we were proposing the ideas, we had meetings in Comcast where he invited, you know, 50 people who worked in the building to come up, when I made a miniature model of the lobby where we projected story animatics and things of scenarios that we were developing. And we actually had focus groups come in and voted on paper what they liked, what they didn't like, what they thought. And even before we actually started shooting, we were having results of like 97% off the Richter scale. When it finally opened, one of the first things that began to show its, I mean, other than people that loved the wall, I mean, loved the original Comcast experience, was the holiday show. Brian wanted desperately to have a, you know, aside from what the wall does every day, during the holiday season, to run a special holiday show. And the first year that we did the holiday show, within several days of this thing opening, it went viral. And the holiday show is a 15-minute or 18-minute show that ran every hour, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, every eight or nine times a day in the lobby of this office building. Mm-hmm. And within several days after opening, every show was jam-packed. You could not get into the lobby of the building. The lobby would hold, I don't know, a couple thousand mm-hmm. people. I mean, enormous success. And you have to imagine, this is a building lobby. There are no chairs in it. There's no place to sit down. All you can do is stand on this granite floor, and people from all over would come running in on the hour to see this spectacle. And now the holiday show is in its 12th year. And we've had, because they eventually put in counters and analytics to see how many people came in, when they came in. We've had millions, that's plural, millions of visitors. Wow. The hardest thing in the world in show business is a free attraction. That's the hardest thing to actually promote. Mm-hmm. Cause I've done, Broadway shows, et cetera, et cetera. You know, once people have bought a ticket, they bought halfway into something. But when you do something for nothing, when it's free, open to the public, it's the most discerning audience. It's the hardest audience. And the success has been phenomenal. Mm. And even though it's, part of the design of the wall is to, we don't do any advertising for Comcast on it. There's almost no branding whatsoever. Yep. But this idea of doing a gift to the city, the public relations response to this wall has been extraordinary. And, people don't like cable companies.
Yeah.
But, even if you go online and you look up Comcast, you'll see, blogs opened up all over the place. We hate Comcast. We don't like the bandwidth. They screwed me out of this. Da, da, da. But that thing that's in the lobby, it's genius.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to paint you as a one-trick pony because I know you've done other work. What are some of the other projects that your team has worked on lately?
Ooh. Well, another one also for Stern, who is the architect of Comcast. We did the George W. Bush Library, which is an interesting, that's a 360-degree video experience. It's in the central part of the library complex called Freedom Hall, which is this very tall, huge square room where people gather, after they pass security to go into the library. They sort of gather in this room before they're actually admitted into the library section. And as they gather in this room, they're basically looking at, what's at ground level, which is doors and paneling and stuff. But, at about 12 feet high, it turns into what looks like a hand-painted mural that goes 360 degrees around them up to a sort of a skyline area. And as they're standing in there, this hand-painted mural, when enough people gather, all of a sudden starts to come to life. It's images of sand dunes and tumbleweeds and sort of a desert landscape, a Texas landscape. It looks hand painted, and all of a sudden it starts to come to life. A couple of tumbleweeds start to move around. A surround sound original orchestra track begins to play, and this goes into an 8-minute presentation It's about the office of the presidency, what the office of the presidency actually means. And it's about the fact that, our presidents come from the people, from the land, to become president. And it's done in a way where we're looking at, again, it's a very big challenge to shoot of these time-lapse images of American landscape, the textures of American landscape in 360 degrees.
Yeah.
Photorealistic above your head, and it's a very inspiring thing. People all of a sudden start pointing and looking. The end of that experience is that the screen explodes into thousands of images, what look like almost passport photos of all kinds of Americans, young, old Americans from 100 years ago. Colors, all races, all this and that, and it turns into this enormous mosaic of these pictures of Americans, and some of these pictures are larger than others, And those pictures that are larger than others are actually what look like passport photos of everybody that's standing in that audience. And somebody will notice it and they start pointing, and it's like popcorn, you know, going off in a popcorn pot. They all start, and it's basically, it's they're incorporated with all these, you know, other basically thousands of pictures. And the pictures begin to dissolve off, leaving, well, today it would be 44 pictures that are up there, that are left up there, that are 44 presidents. Mm-hmm. So it's a very inspiring thing. It's about the office of the presidency. It's not necessarily about a particular president. It's about.
Right.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
There's also in Washington, D.C., we have, the media arch and at City Center, which is a, sort of an archway, which is somewhat. There's no two of my installations that are identical. There's similarities to Comcast in so much as it's got rotating entertainment that's ever changing. It draws quite a large crowd. The other installations we've done in pretty much all over America and in Europe and in China. They're all different, but they're very large installations and also some very small ones. What we love to do is challenges. We constantly like to deal with clients that are saying, this is what we want to accomplish. How do we accomplish it? And by what I mean by accomplish is that they say, well, you know, like in the Comcast experience, it was, you know, Brian Roberts wanted to have his employees feel connected to this building and inspired. At the same time, Liberty Property Trust wanted to create a destination. We love a challenge like that. The Bush Library was another challenge. It was, you know, not to make something specific that is, you know, for Bush, the president, because I mean, that's what the library is there for. This was sort of an overture to the idea of the office of the presidency. In California and in other places, it's you know, people telling us specific goals that they have to see what we can come up with to create something that fills those particular needs. Sometimes commercial, sometimes not commercial. And we love that idea of the challenge. And again, you know, we've done dozens of, you know, tiny lobbies. We have one that we're about to install in New York City, which is a ceiling in a very very important office building, but it's very small. I mean, the lobby is only 18 feet wide and it's about 80 feet long. And we're putting a ceiling in there, which is I mean, the lobby's beautifully been redesigned. And here we're creating a virtual ceiling that is an experience that works from the front door you walk into down this 60-foot lobby that has, you know, a reward to it being there without, you know, without interfering with the architectural design of the lobby. It's complementary. It blends in. It doesn't look like, oh, let's put a screen up there and we'll put a lava lamp on it or something.
Mm-hmm. All right, David, this was terrific. We could talk for hours. I want to thank you for spending some time with me. It was really, really interesting.
Thank you so much for the questions. They're really good.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and you learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around since 2016. You can click around the site and find scores of conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9. That's at 16-9.net. You'll find thousands of posts by me and expert guest writers about this industry. I don't run a press release republishing mill. If something makes it on 16.9, that means it matters in some way to the business. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.